Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with poet and activist Chuck Perkins about his new book, Beautiful and Ugly Too. This is the second of a two-part conversation. The first is available at WWNO.org. I'm so happy to welcome Chuck Perkins to The Reading Life. Chuck is a Renaissance man in our literary community. He wears many hats: activist, poet, spoken word artist, owner of Cafe Istanbul. His new book is Beautiful and Ugly Too. It collects work about the Crescent City where he was born and raised. There are essays about blackface, Mardi Gras, the police, poems about history, music, and people. It is a feast for the heart and a challenge for the mind. Chuck Perkins, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Susan.
A lot of the poems in this book have to do with New Orleans history and New Orleans lore and stuff that you've been steeped in all your life. Mm-hmm. And you do it with varying degrees of seriousness and humor and wisdom, you know. But one of the ones that's sly and funny is Street Names.
Oh, yeah.
Because that shows to me just what a virtuoso you are.
Oh, so thank you so much.
I wonder if you would read that one.
I would love to read that one. Yeah, I'd love to read it. It says, and you know, this is the kind of poem right here, like, and it's okay. But if you're not from New Orleans, you wouldn't have any idea what the hell I was talking about. So this poem
is just for us.
This is for my New Orleans people right here, right? It says, let me say this much. This is how this poem came about. When we came back home for Katrina, one of those first big second lines, right? Mm-hmm. There was this point where the whole moment of the day, it was more like a big family reunion. People were crying. We were all so happy to see each other. And when the whole movement, it was a crescendo, and it was like at the top of the thing. These kids were out there, and they had these street signs, and they started raising. It was like saying humanity, desire, pleasure. And I was like, wow, I was blown away by that.
Oh, wow.
And my aunt Carolyn lived in the St. Thomas Project. And even when they redid the project, she was one of the people who came back to live in one of the old structures. And when I would go to her house, I always went by Religious and Nun Street. And that thing always struck me. So I went out, I got the guy's book, Frenchmen Desire Good Children.
I love it.
I read that book, and so then I came up with this. So I wove the story using all of these New Orleans street names. And it says, Chabatula goes to the market every day. He's a fisherman. After running through Julia and three Greek muses, he comes to Felicity. Napoleon plows through the Roman Colosseum, gathering steam at a cap, headed straight for Chapatulas. Chapatulas has already heard the muffled submission to Napoleon's fury after passing through Milan and Constantinople, so he raced to warn the Chippewa that they shouldn't cross Napoleon. Napoleon runs up the other side of the river to warn the other Chippewa. Instead, he runs into Robert, Amelia, Eleanor, and Duvasat, living his version of the movie Groundhog Day titled Where Did All the White People Come From? In New Orleans, religious run from nuns, and saints double cross each other like two-bit hustlers. When St. Claude crossed St. Philip became so distraught, he ran straight to the Bourbon. St. Claude used to run with good children. He's a Renaissance man. Every day he's running to art, music, painters, desire, and piety. Every day in New Orleans, St. Claude runs from a flood to Poland and France and Spain. Martin Luther King meets the Spanish governors, Galvez and Miro. They try convincing him they're straight shooters. But every day they meet St. Bernard, it end up being crooked. They both started out being smooth. Madison developed a complex because he was too short. Shirley bemoaned the fact that she didn't have any curves. Jeanette is constantly running to Monticello. When is she going to understand that the relationship's a dead-end street? The Frenchman is running to hope, law, benefits, abundance, agriculture, pleasure, and yes, humanity. People always whispering about the Frenchman. Well, I can tell you, I saw him when he went into the quarter. I saw him when he came out. I can assure you, that Frenchman was never straight.
Love that so much. That's so much fun for you to read it.
Oh, yeah.
You know it all. But you draw so richly from your growing up in New Orleans. And it's not all fun like that.
Oh, no.
A lot of it is hard-won knowledge. And one of the poems that struck me as so instructive was What I Know Versus What I Learned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that poem.
Oh, sure. You know, to be honest with you, that poem, What I Knew Versus What I Learned, I think Black people all over this country can probably identify with that poem. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, like we start talking about history and people just say, that's not that big of a deal. You know what I'm saying? History. Why? We have this historical narrative that's been fed to us. You know, when we were kids, let's just stick to that. And we don't, you know, let's not make a big fuss over something so minor, keep moving forward. But really, you know, if you open up, like I said, I went to Xavier University, and that's supposed to be a Black university, right? And so we talk about world civilization. And, you know, there was a great conversation about Egypt. I mean, we talked about, you know, Egyptian civilization for months. And the whole thing about Egyptian civilization is contested. And Martin Bernal, who's Jewish, who has a 3-volume book called Black Athena, he says that the one thing I will say about the race of the Egyptians is that, you know, when you go there to this day, they seem to be lighter on the northern part of the country, and they get darker as you go south. And he said, I'll just say, oftentimes you will discover more about the race of the person who wrote the article about the about the Egyptians. And Martin Bernal left it there. So when I was at Xavier, we talked extensively about Egyptian civilization. There was one paragraph on Ethiopia. And that's that. That's it.
Yeah.
And so I really do think that, like, so when we start talking about scholarship, like, in school, like, all of the scholars were, like white people. Mm-hmm. And for, like, a young Black person, it's a crazy thing. It's like they start feeling like they're not everyone, but there are people who feel like, wait, that's stuff that white people do that. I'm not trying to betray myself. I'm not trying to be something that I'm not. But that's all false. And that's why it's important that we tell a more comprehensive story. Like Ivan Van Sertima wrote a book called They Came Before Columbus.
Right.
There's something he said on the last page that I always keep in mind. He said, I didn't write this book to prove like some kind of racial superiority. He said, that's not why I wrote this book. He said, I only wrote this book to show that we have all contributed to the growth and development of civilization, and we've all taken away. And so I think that in education, we have to show how we've all done that.
Right.
We can't just make it sort of like a one-sided thing. So that's really what I'm trying to hint at with that poem. And then at the end of the poem, you know, here is the kicker. You know, I said, you know, all these years on planet Earth and the people who look like me ain't do nothing but pick cotton. And with, in the case of New Orleans, with all Black classmates and mostly Black teachers. This is what school taught me.
Right. Well, read us this poem.
Oh, you okay.
Read us this poem.
Okay.
Everybody needs to hear this poem.
I said, working class black people made me. I witnessed the daily calculations, not the grotesque caricatures of blackness from Universal Pictures. My kingmakers had depth. I watched them claw their way through the crucible of captivity, outgunned and outmanned, traveling an impossible road from no education and illiteracy to inadequate education. There was still too much talent in the room, possessed by black men and women, even in the tormented souls who had been grinded to shells. Vestiges of wisdom were visible. Before attending school and without ever being told, I knew Mali, Ghana, and Songhai existed. The world could not make sense without their ingenuity. Timbuktu had to exist, and of course, the Dogon understood string theory thousands of years before Columbus. I knew that black people were inventors. I felt it in my gut. My grandpa could fix whatever was broke. Fighting on the African coast, on slave ships, in the Caribbean, and on the mainland, black people bled for their own freedom. No one had to tell me this. Before the movie Glory, I knew the Nubians saved America from itself. Ask Lincoln if I'm lying. I knew something of their fortitude by the way I was protected. My feisty, snuff-dipping great-grandmother, one generation removed from slavery, was nobody's chump. There were rebellions and rumors of rebellion. By day, the persecuted could feign acceptance, and by night, burn down the house. If you saw a happy darky, you were supposed to, but did you miss the blood in their eyes? In the whirlwind of an insult, a smile is always a chagrin. Uncle James had been sent to prison. He used the same hands that held the gun in the robbery to create African art. Angola was the penitentiary named after the country, a ubiquitous insult to the diaspora. It used to be a plantation, and it still is. Every mention of its name guided my uncle's chisel. His wood carvings were black. The subjects had broad features. They held court on the walls in my house. Waking up to a stoic gaze every morning, an African aesthetic was elevated in my home. When I crawled into the world, I already knew black was beautiful. And then I went to school. Gazing at chalkboards for 17 years, from kindergarten to college, turning page after page, learning only about the brilliance of white men. They had a monopoly on inventive genius. The sons of Ham could only claim slavery. Whatever steps taken towards civilization, we could think white people and white Jesus. It's a false equivalence, education synonymous with whiteness. But this is what I learned. Forget about them backward Negroes. Speak the King's English. Learn about Aristotle. Get some whiteness in your life. Since I didn't want to be white, the pursuit of scholarship became an act of self-betrayal. So I rolled a J and let my pants sag. What I learned about black people from living with black people made me proud. What I learned about black people in school brought me shame. All these years on planet Earth, and the people who look like me ain't do nothing but pick cotton with all black classmates and mostly black teachers. That's what school taught me.
That's an amazing poem. I think they should teach that poem in school. Don't you?
Yes, I do. And you know, one thing I wanted to point out about that poem, like the part where I talk about how black people bled for their own freedom. Like there's a book that came out on the slave uprising of 1811. And the guy who wrote that book, he was a Yale guy, but he said something that other historians had said the same thing. Like when the Civil War started and the slaves started running to the side of the Union, that really is, you know, their work and their effort helped to tilt the war in favor of the Union. But that's just something that simple. I'd never heard that before. No one ever told me that. There's another historical thing that I think is huge, and I think it should be taught in history classes all over this country. There are a lot of historians who agree that during the Haitian War, that before that slave uprising in Haiti, like the French had big plans for the Louisiana Purchase, but once they lost the war in Haiti, that's when they decided, okay, well,
we're done.
We'll get rid of this. We got other things happening on the other side of the ocean, and we'll sell the Louisiana Purchase. So now in America, there's always been this idea of a manifest destiny that had existed, you know, going from the Atlantic to the Pacific. And so after that slave uprising, the United States of America doubled in size. And once it doubled in size, it made it, you know, the goal to eventually get to the Pacific Ocean, and it made it that much more possible. I think that kind of stuff should be taught, but it isn't.
Well, we have lifetimes to work at that. Still, it's like that transformation you go through when you learn enough about New Orleans history to see the city as it was, like the fact that it was a monument to slavery. And some people don't see that.
Right.
Most people do now. Now, you know, it's been a terrific re-education process, I think.
You're absolutely right, Susan.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with poet, activist Chuck Perkins about his new book. Your biography, I love this, uses the word orator, which is kind of an old-fashioned word. What does that mean to you, to be an orator?
I guess I'm very comfortable, you know, talking to people, you know. Mm-hmm. So if, you know, if I'm in front of a crowd and it's about a subject that I'm familiar with, I'm fortunate that people who like the sound of my voice.
Yes, they do.
Right. And and I'm a pretty passionate guy. And, you know, I don't have an issue with trying to deliver an idea.
You're not afraid of crowds.
I am not afraid of crowds. But boy, once Evan Christopher, the clarinetist, he brought me out. He was at the jazz tent. And he bought me out. And he said, I want you to read this one poem. And I said, oh, great. And, you know, to talk is one thing. But to, you know, somebody's doing the playing a particular song and to remember these, like, all of these words. And so I'm sitting stage left and I'm just going over all of my stuff. I'm going over. And then all of a sudden, Evan looked at me, gave me the nod. He was ready for me to come up and do my part. Right. And it was at the jazz tent, at Jazz Fest. And I looked at about 5,000 people out there. And then everything went blank for about.
Oh, no.
For the first 60 seconds, I blanked out. And so I guess, you know.
But you came back.
I came back.
But still, you are such an important voice. I mean, what you have to say matters. It's so consequential. And you've been working at it so hard and so long.
Well, thank you very much, Susan.
You know, you have this kind of warrior heart about you.
Well, thank you.
It just sort of keeps on going.
And you know, I wanted to say this, just a couple of days ago, I said something to somebody. He said, "Oh man, well you sound radical, you know." But it's a guy who's really like he's a super radical. I was like, "Well, listen, let me tell you something." I said, "For me, I just want to tell the truth, right?"
Right.
And in telling the truth, like I don't believe that I should be able to say something, anything, and be unchallenged, right? Now, if I say anything in my poems, in my essays, anything, and if somebody say, wait a second, Chuck Perkins, you said this, but you can't, then you have a right to come to me, and I could either defend what it is I said, or I can't, but I will never say, hey, well, listen, this is just my art. You don't have the right. No, if I say it and you think I'm wrong, then you have a right to challenge me. Mm-hmm. Now, if I can't defend what it is I'm saying, then I'm gonna have to go back to the lab and reconsider my position and draw some other conclusions about what it is. And so, if someone comes to me and gives me some information that I didn't have, I appreciate that.
Yeah,
because I don't want to be wrong. And so, I don't feel like we ever have to be afraid of just telling the truth, mm-hmm. period. And if people are upset by the truth, then I can't. There's nothing I can do about that.
You bring a lot to what you write. You bring your life as a father, as a son, as a twin.
Yep.
Which I think is so interesting.
Yep.
You know, and you've done all different kinds of things and had all different kinds of experiences.
That's true.
So preach to us a little bit with the Gospel of Chuck.
The Gospel of Chuck. Thank you.
Take us out with the Gospel
okay.
of Chuck.
Okay. I said, blessed are the grandmothers who raise their grandchildren. They find reciprocity in the happiness of the babies. Their gift will be a new world constructed on the building blocks of unrelenting devotion, where they sing and dance and be joyful without worry because the work is done. They will rest in the glory of the ultimate guardian. Their hearts will be unbreakable. Every child will have a mother and father, and they will rest easy. Blessed are the men who are fathers, not by blood. Theirs is a rare virtue. They have aced the test of humanness. Forever unaware, their mundane machinations are philanthropic. Their gift will be a world of radiant sunshines where all men exercise the best attributes of the best fathers. Love will reproduce love like the cells of Henrietta Lacks, and billions of souls will coexist in perfect harmony. Blessed are the boys who free their mothers from poverty. They watch them work like 21st century sharecroppers, trying to bring comfort to their families, running on a hamster wheel, but losing ground. Sometimes the mothers are beaten to submission. Sometimes they self-medicate on alcohol or Jesus. The boy's dream is to take her hand and carry her safely to the other side of the turbulent waters. The love between these mothers and sons did not start at the crossing of the birth canal. This sacred love precedes time. If the world is to make sense, maternal virtue must be rewarded. Their gift will be a world where sons rest easy because their mothers rest easy, and every day is bursting with the gratitude of Christmas morning when there's something special for everyone. Blessed are the children who liberate themselves from poverty with natural ability, heart, and tenacity. Defying all odds, they are remarkable. Their gifts will be a world where hope and promise are not obliterated before puberty, dreams are not deferred, and all people die in full command of their potential with a keen sense of equality. Mother Nature will continue to grace each person with everything required to be exceptional, and all societies will assist their citizens in the pursuit of finding their life's purpose, minus the gravitational bulldozer of historic and generational poverty. None of the precious stones will have to be uncovered. Everyone will shine. Blessed are the prodigal sons, the ones possessed by the spirit of Sankofa. They have left the village, acquiring so much knowledge, but their return is necessary to teach, coach, and mentor. There are lessons to learn for everyone. Their gift will be a world where the only need to return is for love and celebration. Blessed are the women with subpar wages, who are mothers to all. They will manifest a plate of food, a warm jacket, a hug when needed, without the condescension cloaked in fake altruism. Their gifts will be a world where every person has a table, and the centerpiece of every table is a cornucopia. The angels will eat well. Blessed are the ones who offer second chances. They know the human soul is redeemable. They can forgive even while hurting. Shouts of fool will be heard from the ecumenical choir, but the forgivers are near to the one. They are the redemption of humanity. Their gift will be a world where hell doesn't exist, only purgatory. Every soul will be granted time to perfect divinity. When the golden trumpets blow, the saints marching in will be the heavenly soundtrack. Blessed are the ones who live with vigor. Despite life's tragic comedy, they walk with eagerness, drinking the wine, smelling the roses, and eating the dreaded apple. Sometimes they overindulge all this and more without regret. They laugh, cry, and curse their maker. They're the most evolved amongst us. Their gift will be a world perfect in its imperfection, where no one is afraid to be human.
What a world. What a world. We've been talking with Chuck Perkins, whose new book collects his poetry and essays. It's called Beautiful and Ugly Too. Chuck, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Susan. I really, really do appreciate you bringing me back here, because the last time I was here, it's been a couple years, but it's good to be back here.
Well, I appreciate you too. Thank you. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. New Orleans poets will gather to commemorate the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina in a special edition of the Poetry Buffet, Saturday, August 2nd at 2 at Ladder Library. Daniel Krause, author of Whalefall, appears in conversation with Jamie Attenberg to discuss and sign his new novel, Angel Down, Sunday, August 3rd at 5:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Lindsay Kelk discusses and signs her new book, The Bell Witches, Thursday, August 7th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Chuck Perkins signs Beautiful and Ugly Too, Friday, August 8th at 8 p.m. at Cafe Istanbul. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library will sponsor a warehouse and puzzle sale from 9 to 4, Saturday, August 9th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Patrons are encouraged to come early. Past sales have sold out in less than 1 hour. Boxes of books in various categories will be sold for a set price, including CDs, DVDs, children's books, cookbooks, and regular fiction. Boxes cannot be opened prior to purchasing. Puzzles and school supplies will also be for sale. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org. Thank you.